Over 600 songs, 62 musicians, 22 singers, 37 weeks at number one, 9 songs, 8 Grammys, 7 top 10 singles, and that's just some of the stats associated with Michael Jackson's Thriller album. So how do you create the biggest selling album of all time? Well, you're about to find out. This is Creating Thriller.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
This is Vincent Price inviting you to
The Thriller.
And the producer of the year is Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson.
E.T., the extraterrestrial. Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, album producer.
And the winner is Michael Jackson.
Thriller!
The record of the year is Beat It.
The Guinness Book of World Records has listed Thriller as the biggest selling album of all time.
So, where did the idea for Thriller begin? Author and self-confessed fan, Mick Lynch explains.
I suppose the seeds for the creation of what would become Thriller were sown the night of the Grammy Awards in 1980. Jackson's fifth solo album, Off the Wall, won a solitary Grammy, and Michael was far from impressed. Watching the events on TV with his sister at home, he said, "Watch LaToya, my next record. I am going to sell more records and win more Grammys than anyone in the history of music." Despite Off the Wall becoming the biggest selling album by a black artist, Michael was focused on the idea that he would not just create something to equal or even surpass Off the Wall, but an album on which every song would be a hit single. He actually didn't believe in B-sides.
Immediately, Michael set to work on gathering a bunch of songs that would form the basis for Thriller, along with producer Quincy Jones, engineer Bruce Swedeen, and songwriter Rod Temperton, the same dream team that had worked on Off the Wall.
I don't understand the way you think, saying that she's just not mine. Sitting roses and your silly dreams, it's really just a waste of time, because she's mine. The doggone girl is
During the 1980 festive season, Michael phoned Paul McCartney in the UK, possibly to offer him condolences following the recent passing of John Lennon. Here's Paul speaking to David Letterman.
It was Christmas and I was at home and my phone rang and a little voice, you know, talked to me. And I said, "Who's this?" You know, kind of guarding my privacy, private number. I said, "Who's this?" "It's Michael." I said, "Michael who?" Because I thought it was, you know, a little bit sort of dodgy. But anyway, he said, "Michael Jackson." He said, "You want to make some hits?" So I said, yeah. Sure. So, you know, being of the hit-making variety. So we did, and it was really nice. You know, he came to my house, and we got to know the family and stuff. And he had a great guy who used to come with him, a guy called Billy. So it was very nice. We had a really good time. We made a couple of records together, did a video, and we're very good friends.
Through the years, how can you stand here? My place in fire, you know I'm crying.
Despite recording The Man and Say 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 together in 1981, these tracks wouldn't be released till 1983, when they ended up on Paul's Pipes of Peace album. But Mac and Jack would work together again before that. Michael had covered the Wings song Girlfriend on Off the Wall and wanted to repay the favor. So as Quincy explains, they visited Paul in December 1981 to rehearse a new song Michael had written.
The Girl Is Mine was fun. Paul was in Tucson and we had to go down there and work with him for 2 or 3 days, which was fun. And rehearsing the song and finding things, you know, just finding things that make them tailor-made for them, like the verse at the end and the rap they had, you know, them fighting over the same girl. And this came out first.
It was Quincy who suggested they record a rap at the end of the record. This was the first song recorded for the album when the recording sessions began in April 1982. The studio was a who's who of the music business, including Michael, Quincy, Bruce, Paul and Linda McCartney, George Martin and Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick
were all there. The band Toto were invited to take part on the session, including keyboardist David Page and drummer Jeff Beccaro. Steve Lukather was certainly excited to be there.
We get the call, we go down and do the session. And, you know, Paul and Linda walk in, and they were so nice and so great. And I was so, like, I was trying not to keep my jaw in my mouth. And just to loosen it up, I think Paige started playing I Was Made to Love Her, because, you know, and Jeff jumped in, and I started playing, and they started singing. And it was in the phones. I'm going, this is like, you're kidding me, right? Am I going to wake up here anymore? And it went great. And then we cut the track very quickly, and I came up with kind of a cool little part, and Paul goes, that's a great part, man. And at that point, I could have died. And Michael was cool. Everybody was fine. Quincy was like, oh, this is great. Man, we got the track and everything. I walked out of there going, wow. Leading up to that, well, I was going to meet Paul. And like, we were all really nervous. We almost had to be vetted because it was very soon after the tragic loss of John, being around new people in Hollywood and just wanted, you know, I mean, not they were scared of me, but it was like they wanted to know who everybody was on the session. Mm-hmm. Super high security and all that stuff because Michael, and, you know, there's the, you know, the two big, you know, biggest stars in the world at the time.
So as Mick Lynch explains, The Girl Is Mine became the first taster for the album.
From a record company point of view, it's two iconic artists working together, so it was the obvious first single. Michael had started to make a name for himself as a solo artist outside the US the previous year, when one of his old Motown recordings, One Day in Your Life, topped the UK charts. So Epic Records were now focusing on a simultaneous worldwide release both sides of the Atlantic for the album. The decision for the single was justified when it peaked at number 2 on the Billboard charts around the release time of the album.
With The Girl Is Mine in the bag, Jackson continued recording for the album, and with Jones, they searched to find the range and balance that would create the album he was dreaming of. Michael had some songs in demo form that hadn't made the previous record, but he also started writing new songs, and apparently wrote at least 50 for this album, some of which he brought to the table. Quincy also put out a request for songs to be submitted, and he listened to anything from 600 to 800 songs to find the best 9 that would eventually be chosen. Mick tells us about one of those early songs Michael had written.
One of those songs already demoed was Wanna Be Starting Something, a song he'd written during the off-the-wall period, but went unused. The song's memorable feature was an African chant in the concluding section, a variation on Cameroonian saxophonist Manu Dibango's 1972 disco hit Soul Makossa. According to Quincy, Michael heard that and he liked it, but Jones told him, that's Manu Dibango's record. But Michael replied, but I need it. Michael knew this was the song he wanted to open the album with. Dibango, incidentally, wasn't given a songwriting credit on the album, but a financial settlement was eventually reached. 25 years later, Rihanna ran into similar problems when she sampled it on Don't Stop the Music.
Among the other songs cut during the early phases of the Thriller sessions were some demos by Rod Temperton. Rod was a British musician who had written the hits Always and Forever, The Groove Line, and the classic Boogie Nights as keyboardist with the American disco funk band Heatwave. He had contributed 3 songs to the Off the Wall album, including the title track and Rock With You. He submitted several songs to Quincy again for this album, including The Lady in My Life and Baby Be Mine.
And we can share this ecstasy as long as we believe in love.
Another song that Rod had a hand in composing didn't end up on the album. During the recording of Thriller, as if Quincy and Michael hadn't enough on their plate, friend Steven Spielberg asked them to record a song and an audiobook for the film he was in production with. As Quincy explains, that movie was E.T.
We got kind of trapped on Thriller because we had about 4 months to do it, which isn't a long time when you're following 10 million albums, you know, because we had to do E.T. first. That's what we got in trouble with, because we had to do the E.T. storybook, because I had just met Steven, and I introduced Michael to Steven Spielberg. And when I met Spielberg, he was doing E.T. at Laird, and I was doing Thriller with Michael. And so we were really cross-pollinating everything. You know, he was coming over to the sessions, I've gone to the Laird, Michael's gone over there, and Michael loved what that was about, you know. Ironically, we were both making two huge pieces of stuff, you know, at the time, but didn't nobody knew, you know, nobody, you never know. We had to take the biggest film in the history of the cinema, successful, and visual, and reduce it to an oral version, 40-minute version.
My friend, my someone in the dark was you.
The E.T. storybook, narrated by Michael, was released by MCA 2 weeks before Thriller, despite conditions by Epic Records that it shouldn't be released until after Michael's album. As a result, Epic took legal action against MCA, which forced the album's withdrawal, making it a collector's item. Despite all of this, it won Michael a Grammy Award for Best Recording for Children. From the beginning, Jackson had a very clear sense of the sound and the groove for Billie Jean, one of four songs he contributed to the album. In 1981, he recorded a home demo.
More kicking stuff in the phones, I need it. More bottom and kick in the phones.
What was the inspiration for Billie Jean? Here's Quincy.
Well, it starts with, you know, it all starts with a song. And Michael wrote Billie Jean and that stuff, you know, it was just highly, highly personal. According to him, he said it was about a girl that climbed over the wall and the fellow was lounging out there. She woke up one morning, she was laying out in the pool, lounged and hanging out, had some shades on, a bathing suit on. It's about just like invaded the place, a stalker almost. And he had accused, Michael said she had accused him of being the father of one of her twins. I said, how do you do that? And Michael, on Billie Jean, he had an intro, you could shave on an intro so long. And so I said, Smelly, it's too long, you know, we got to get to the melody quicker. He said, but that's the jelly, that's what makes me want to dance. Now, when Michael Jackson tells you that's what makes me want to dance, the rest of us have to shut up, you know, because it's not Bruce or Rodney, I'm not going to say, well, that's what makes me dance, you know. So we had to, he won, you know, it was a quorum.
Mick Lynch discusses the real Billie Jean.
Billie Jean was actually based on fact, though Jackson never revealed that to those he worked with. When a Rolling Stone journalist noticed a photo tucked into a picture frame in Jackson's home, Michael acknowledged that she was the real Billie Jean. The journalist described her as a coloured teenager. Michael said she had written to him, claiming that he had fathered her child and sent him a weapon with instructions about when and how he should take his own life. Michael said, I want to memorise her face in case she ever does turn up someplace. But by the time he released his Moonwalk book in the late 80s, he'd had reservations over what he told the journalist previously and changed his story. There never was a real Billie Jean, he wrote. The girl in the song is a composite of people we've been plagued by over the years.
So musically, where did Michael get the idea for Billie Jean from? Daryl Hall of the duo Hall & Oates might just have the answer.
We were doing the We Are the World session. Everybody was talking to everybody else because there was just the artists in the rooms. And Michael came up to me, you know, in conversation, and he goes, hey, man, I hope you don't mind if I stole No Can Do. and I went, what do you mean you stole No Can Do? He says, nah, man, I used it for Billie Jean. He said that to me. I thought that was pretty cool that he said that. But to me, that just goes to show you, though, an artist can take something that even they may think is a ripoff or whatever you want to call it, but it's not at all.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was maybe in the slight, if you really wanted to stretch it a little bit, you could hear the two things together. But anyway, he did say it.
Michael had called the song Billie Jean, but Quincy was worried that people would think it was a song about tennis champion Billie Jean King. It was almost released as Not My Lover, but Michael won this argument. Engineer Bruce Swedeen and Michael spent longer on this song than any other on the album. as Bruce explains.
So we're mixing Billie Jean, and my understand, I adore Michael. He's the greatest. And Michael is very, very polite, and he's a wonderful guy to work with. And he would say, Bruce, that's perfect, but let's try one more. And this is like mix 80. So I say, no problem. So we did it. And then finally we got up to mix 91. And Quincy came in the control room and said, what are you guys doing in here all this time? And so we told him, Quincy, we're mixing Billie Jean. And we got a fabulous mix. And Quincy Jones cuts right to the chase and he says, let me hear it. Let me hear this POS you think you're making so perfect. So we played it for him. Came to the end. Got real quiet in the control room. Quincy said to me and Michael, he said, okay, guys, let's listen to mix 2. So we played mix 2. It blew it all away. I mean, that was the most badass mix. That's what went out on Billie Jean, mix 2.
One of the songs that didn't make the final selection was Behind the Mask, originally released by Yellow Music Orchestra in the late 70s. Quincy brought it to Michael's attention in the 80s, and Michael added additional lyrics and melody and recorded it for the album. The track, however, was left off the album due to a royalties and publishing dispute with the band's management. Another song that didn't make the final track listing for Thriller was a Michael Cimbello song called Carousel. Here's Quincy.
Fortunately or unfortunately, you know, hearing there was only room on the album for one mood like Carousel or Human Nature. And Human Nature was the choice we had to make, you know. But they were hard to give up, you know. It was not like they were songs that were bad songs at all, you know. So we did a thing that Mike Cimbello had written. This was around when he had done Maniac and stuff for Flashdance. I love Cimbello.
Oh, 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 I lost my heart on the carousel. I do a circus girl who left my heart in pieces. Lost my heart on
By this stage, Michael and Quincy had their quota of songs. Quincy said, when we got down to 9, we put those on their feet to see if they stood up. He says, I tried to be as objective as I could, take the weakest of those 9 and replace them. They weren't weak. It was great stuff, but you have to be realistic. Rod Temperton concurs.
When we first went in the studio to make the real album, we, I believe, did 9 cuts. As the tracks and did some vocals on them. And at that point, we kind of stepped back from it for a minute and had a listen to everything and realized that 3 or 4 of the cuts, not that they were bad, but were just not fitting in with the way the album appeared to be going. I mean, right from the beginning, Michael had written Billie Jean, and everybody knew, you know, we knew that that was going to be a cornerstone of the album. And the style of that and Starting Something, which is another track Michael had written for it, plus what was to become Thriller, we're kind of giving the whole thing an edge and a direction that some of the other tracks didn't have. They seemed a little too poppy and too straightforward for where we appeared to be going. So that's why those tracks never made the album. And one of them was Carousel, which was a great song, a slowish song from Michael Cimbello, which was beautiful. But lyrically and at that point in time, it didn't seem that that was where the album was heading to. And it was just one of those things. But eventually they were all replaced with Beat It, The Lady in My Life, Human Nature, which were some of the best things on the album. So I don't think it was a mistake in the end analysis.
Keyboardist Greg Fillingales added, "There was a point we thought it was all over, that we were all finished. There had been so much hard work and long hours, but Quincy proclaimed, 'It's not there yet.' And Michael, almost distraught, was saying, 'What are we going to do now?' Quincy felt there was certain elements that were missing still and went back to the drawing board. But another song had presented itself that had the same sort of mood as Carousel." Toto's Steve Beccaro explains.
Toto was in the studio mixing our fourth album. Anyway, I wanted to stop by and visit my daughter, who was around 4 or 5 years old at the time. She had gotten home from school. I wanted to stop by and say hello to her at her mom's house before I went to the studio and met the guys. And my daughter Heather was very upset. She had had a real rough day at school. She had fallen off the slide, and a boy came up and hit her. And she was asked me why the boy came up and hit her, trying to figure out how to explain to a 5-year-old that, you know, he probably liked her in some way or just wanted to get her attention. And anyway, just the title Human Nature, kind of the thought of human nature came, trying to explain human nature to a kid, you know, when she says why, you know. And I went to the studio. The guys were that night, they were in the booth mixing the song Africa. And I went out to the studio where the piano was, and one sitting. And then John Bettis came and rewrote the verse lyrics, but the chorus lyrics and all that, and pretty much the structure of the song came out. First chords I wrote were...
They sent over 2 demos, 2 things they thought would be right for Michael. And we left the tape on and forgot to take it off the tape they sent with the first 2 songs, which were okay, but we're not impressed, you know.
He describes that he had listened to the tape and he had let it go. And then all of a sudden he hears Human Nature. And so the only conclusion I could come to is that all cassettes then had auto reverse, that it must have run to the end, because it wasn't a really long cassette tape. It wasn't like it was a hour-long cassette tape or a 90-minute cassette tape. We had these short ones that we had that could just fit a couple songs on it. So the only thing I can imagine, and this is my assumption, was that the tape ran out. Quincy said he left it running, and that auto-reverse kicked in, and he heard Human Nature, you know.
And all of a sudden, this, at the end, there was all this silence, and I said, why? 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 That was all. It was just a dummy lyric and just a very skeletal thing. And I tell you, I do goosebumps just talking about it. And I said, what the hell is that? You know, that's what took Carousel out. I said, this is where we want to go because it's got such a wonderful flavor. So I called up David and he said, yeah, Steve Beccaro wrote that. That's a little demo he had on the end of our tape, you know. And I called Chuck Kay to get John Bettis to write a lyric to it.
So what had happened was the next day, David calls me into the house. He says, I just got off the phone with Quincy. And he goes, he was raving on for like 20 minutes about this song, Why, you know, that we had sent over. And I didn't know what David didn't know what he was talking about. He goes, it took me a half an hour to realize that it was your song that he was talking about.
Quincy wasn't happy with Beccaro's lyrics, so he sent a demo to songwriter John Bettis, who had written numerous songs for the likes of The Carpenters and Madonna's Crazy for You. Bettis had it finished in 48 hours for Michael. So why didn't Toto record the song? Here's Steve again.
You know, at one point it was played for Toto. A demo of it was played for Toto at one point. And the guys love to tell this story where at the time, like I said, Toto was kind of getting more and more... trying to be tougher and bigger and more like what they would call, you know, what they called stadium rock, you know, more of a stadium rock band and not play these sensitive ballads and stuff and get, you know, bigger and bigger guitar and all that. And when Michael was touring, it was the Victory Tour with his brothers where he was doing the Thriller album and performing Human Nature. It was funny because for that whole summer they were touring and we were on the road too. The only song Michael would allow the news, the local newscasters, to shoot was Human Nature.
Final additions to the Thriller lineup revealed the tactical thinking of the producer. Michael was setting out to make the biggest album in history, and Quincy knew just what to do.
Because I think half a producer's job is assuring you got the right songs, and that's the biggest conflict you have sometimes with the artists. If they write a lot of songs, is they are in love with everything they write, and it's hard for them to kill their babies, you know. But at one point, you got to make a decision and choose a group of songs and say, this is it. I think for a record to penetrate like this record did, you have to be go for the throat in 4, 5, or 6 different areas, you know, incredible areas, you know, where you do a rock and roll kind of a trip, you know, you do your AC thing, you know, dance stuff, R&B, soul, whatever you want to call it.
The inspiration for PYT came from Quincy. His wife had been out shopping and bought new lingerie, and written on them were the words, "Pretty Young Thing." Jones pitched this as a song title to Michael and various others, and asked them to write a song around it. Michael submitted his version. It wasn't what Quincy was really looking for, as Mick Lynch explains.
Quincy felt they could do better. James Ingram submitted a different demo that Quincy preferred, but he insisted Ingram continue working on the lyrics. Quincy was credited as a songwriter on this track, along with Ingram. For the studio recording, Michael's sisters Janet and Latoya were on backing vocals and hand claps. Michael was a fan of the spoken intro record. He'd incorporated it into Don't Stop Till You Get Enough on Off The Wall, and used it later on I Just Can't Stop Loving You on Bad. But now, this was the trailer track that included one. I want to love you.
Quincy still had one ace up his sleeve. The album didn't have a guitar-influenced track, so he challenged Michael to write a rock song. Here's Quincy again.
We double clutch and release, Beat It, and this is real key to this record being with its power, with everything it has, because I said at the time, I need a song like My Sharona. But I mean, we need to do like a black version of, you know, just a strong rock and roll thing that has the power and everything else he writes. And he says, I got something here, but I don't have any voices on it. So we sat out at this outside of his studio in Havenhurst, and he wouldn't put it on. Right on the head. That's just what we needed, you know.
Okay, this is the harmonies and the vocal harmonies on the choruses of Beat It. I'll do the verses, then I'll do the choruses. 1, 2, 3, 4.
And I decided to call Eddie Van Halen, and I didn't know him, to come play the solo and Beat It. And I called, said, it's Quincy Jones. Bam! Cussed me out every time, you know, because he thought somebody was stroking him, you know. So I did it about 3 times, and then I think I called somebody else to tell him that just, I'm serious, you know. And I called back finally, and he was very sweet, you know, and everything else. So we connected, and Michael was in the one studio, I think, doing overdubs, the vocal overdubs on Billie Jean. I went to the other studio, a third studio, And Eddie came in, he had his Gibsons, stacked his Gibsons all up there, and I kind of let him get set up and everything else. I said, I'm not going to sit here trying to tell you what to play. The reason you're here is because what you do play. So let's try 3 or 4 takes. Some of it will be over animated, some of it will be long lines and so forth. We'll sculpt it, okay? And if we did, he played his ass off.
Beat It once again showed the maturity in Jackson's songwriting. Lyrically, it condemned violence. Michael's demo had convinced Quincy they had something. And speaking to Piers Morgan, Eddie Van Halen explains his part on the record.
It was about 20 minutes out of my life. Quincy had called me up and asked me if I wanted to do it. And the honest God truth, the band's policy was, you know, we don't do things outside of the band at the time. And everybody's out of town, so I had no one to ask. And I swear to God, I figured, who's going to know if I play on this Black Kids record? The funniest thing of all was I actually rearranged the song. The section they wanted me to solo over, it was just, you know, there's no chord changes underneath it. So I had to rearrange the song. And then Michael came in and I said, oh, I hope you don't mind, I changed your song. And he listens and he goes, no, I really like that high fast stuff you do.
Eddie Van Halen had some competition on Beat It, as Mick Lynch explains.
When Steve Lukather heard that Eddie was going to add the solo, he decided to up his game and took out his Marshall guitars and did a wall of sound on it. But being the genius that Quincy is, he sent that back and said, the guitars are too heavy, they'll never play this on R&B radio. So Lukather dropped down to Fenders instead. While Eddie was recording his guitar solo, an assistant knocked on the studio door and intended to enter, but realised they were recording. The sound of that knocking on the door was left in for the finished version and can be heard just before Van Halen's solo. Eddie even refused payment for the session, however, he did get in trouble with his band later.
Funny, because at the time I had played on Beat It, on Michael Jackson's record, and his album went to number one, and our album was number two. Our single was number one, his single was number two. Then he did a Pepsi commercial, he burned his hair, and he stayed at number one.
Selfish, man.
To this day, you know, the guys in the band still blame me for that album not going to number one.
When they were finishing Beat It, they had 3 studios going. They had Eddie Van Halen in one, Michael was in another, and they were mixing in another. They were working 5 days and 5 nights with no sleep, and at one point, the speakers overloaded and caught fire. It was late October 1982, and everyone was working flat out around the clock at Westlake Recording Studios in Los Angeles, putting the finishing touches to Michael's new album. The Girl Is Mine had already been released, adding additional pressure to wrap things up quickly. The overdubs on Beat It were the last parts recorded for Thriller. The team worked until 9 a.m. Bruce took the tapes to be mastered and Quincy Jones took Michael back to his house to get some sleep, and then they had to go back at noon to listen to the master. As Mick Lynch reveals, not everything went smoothly.
According to Quincy, the head of black music at Epic Records, Larkin Arnold, was pouring champagne before any music was listened to. Unfortunately, the album didn't have the punch they were hoping for. It was too long to fit on a standard LP for one thing, requiring thin grooves, and it sounded terrible. Michael was sobbing and very unhappy because they hadn't achieved their ultimate goal, and he ran out of the room crying. A group decision was made that the album needed to be shorter. Quincy told the record company that he couldn't hand it over like this. He decided to remix the album and get it back to them in 10 days. He gave everyone 2 days off and decided that because the single The Girl Is Mine was already out, that would remain unchanged. So it was 8 tracks in 8 days. They decided to cut a verse from The Lady in My Life, shortening it by more than a minute. On Billie Jean, they cut the introduction by 18 seconds, took out a section of the guitar solo from the bridge, and took another minute off the end of it. PYT and Wannabe Starting Something were also cut, and they deleted Vincent Price's second verse from Thriller.
Okay, tape rolling, anytime you want.
The demons squeal in sheer delight. It's you they spy, so plump, so right. For though the groove is hard to beat, yet still you stand with frozen feet. You try to run, you try to scream, but no more sun you'll ever see. For evil reaches from the crypt to crush you in its icy grip.
Engineer Bruce Swedeen had now got the album down to 20 minutes on side one and 22 minutes on side two. The final day of mixing was November 8th, and by November 30th, Thriller was available in the shops. And the rest, as they say, is history. However, Thriller took some time to take off. The first reviews weren't positive. Rod Temperton recalls Melody Maker's review headline saying, "The thrill has gone." But things were about to change, as Mick Lynch explains.
According to Bob Pittman, MTV only had a selection of 250 videos to choose from to keep their channel running, so they were always looking for videos from music artists. In the week that Billie Jean topped both the UK and US charts simultaneously in March 83, MTV premiered it. They hadn't played many black artists before, so this was a watershed moment, putting Billie Jean on heavy rotation of 8 plays per day. From that moment, Thriller was unstoppable. Epic's head of promotion, Frank DeLeo, who would later become Michael's manager, decided to release two singles concurrently in order to capitalize on the exposure. Beat It was rush-released while Billie Jean was at number one, which was unprecedented, and the album soared, helped in no small terms by Michael's Motown 25 appearance in front of 33 million viewers, where he premiered his moonwalk for the first time, all accumulating in Thriller topping the Billboard charts for 37 non-consecutive weeks.
Prior to the Thriller album, record companies only promoted three or four singles from an album, but in a 14-month time frame, Epic released seven of the nine tracks from Thriller, the latest being the title track in the UK. MTV wanted another video, and came to an agreement that they wouldn't pay for it, but would pay for a behind-the-scenes The Making of Thriller video, which would become a bestseller, win a Grammy, and contribute to the overall cost of the John Landis production. So 4 days were spent recording in LA. The iconic video premiered in December 1983, almost a year after the album was released, and MTV created time slots for the 14-minute video, which it aired up to five times per day. Quincy explains how important the videos were.
During that time, MTV had just come along, and they were playing rock and roll. They weren't supposed to be playing jazz artists. That wasn't their policy then, or whatever it is, whatever you want to call it. But the ironic part, Michael kind of defined what the videos were. Everybody's basically still doing the same thing. You know, they got a line, I don't care who it is, Christina Aguilera, Madonna, everything else, they're doing the same thing Michael did, you know. And they defined, you know, that I have to say, at least Billie Jean between the video and Beat It with the West Side Story thing. Michael did, and Michael Peters. Thriller was a whole other thing, because that became like a small movie, you know, and it was a year and a half after the record came out, and it was like an event. But the newness of MTV and the video, they rode each other to glory.
Another Rod Temperton song had begun life as Starlight. Starlight morphed into Midnight Man, but eventually became Thriller. Here, Rod and Quincy explain how they lured Vincent Price into the recording.
When I wrote Thriller, I'd always envisioned this kind of talking section at the end, and didn't really know what we were going to do with it. But one thing I'd thought about was to have somebody, a famous voice in the horror genre, to do this vocal.
Peggy, my wife at the time, Peggy Lipton, she was a very good friend of Vincent Price. And man, if you're dealing with a horror film, who is better than Peter Lorre or Vincent Price? I mean, please, you know. So that just felt like it was very natural, you know.
And so Quincy said to me, "How about if we got Vincent Price?" And I said, "Well, that'd be amazing if we could, you know, get him." So he spoke to his wife and they got it together, and Vincent said he would love to do it. So it was all set up that he would come in and do it. And the idea was going to be that he would just talk some horror talk from the type of lines he would deliver in some of his famous roles. And right up until the night before the session, and just before I went to bed, Quincy called me and said, "You know, the session's at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and I'm a bit scared because Vincent's never been in on a pop record before. I don't know that he's ever recorded in such a manner with music, tracks and headphones and everything. And it may be difficult for him to come up with something to do. So perhaps you better write something for him to say, just in case we get stuck. So I said, okay, no problem. I'll get up tomorrow morning and write it before we come to the studio. So I went off to bed, and the very next morning at 9 o'clock, the bell rings, and I'd totally forgotten this, but my publisher from England had come over to America, and it had always been planned that we would have breakfast that next morning. And so I had the breakfast with my publisher and had a long business meeting, which went up till noon. And the session was at 2 o'clock. And finally, my publisher left, and about 12:10, the phone rings, and it's Quincy. Says, how are you doing? Have you got something? And I said, yeah, well, don't worry about it. I'll have something. I'm just finishing it off. And so I hung up and got a piece of paper and frantically started to write some stuff. And just one of those lucky times that it just flowed out of me. I'd written all the lyrics for the song, and the theme of the whole thing was so strong anyway that it was quite easy to visualize all these kind of lines that Vincent would say. And so I started writing, and I wrote one verse there while I was waiting for the taxi. And then I got in the taxi, and while I'm going to the studio, I wrote two more whole verses.
And Rod was great. He I was calling him in the cab on the way to the date, you know, and so forth. And he wrote this brilliant Edgar Allan Poe spiel, and that it just knocked me on socks off, you know.
Of which, so I wrote three verses of poetry or rap. And we only needed two in the end anyway. And as I arrived at the studio, I saw a car pull up and out steps Vincent Price. And the taxi pulled around the back of the studio, and I dived out of the cab, raced in the back door, said to the secretary, photocopy this quick. And they put it on the music stand, and he walked in and sat down in his chair, and off we went.
Engineer Bruce Swedeen's dog was supposed to provide the howling on the title track, but no matter what they tried, he wouldn't oblige. So in the end, Michael done the wolf howls himself.
The foulest stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
Mick's final reflection on Thriller's achievements.
By the end of 1983, Thriller was the biggest selling album in music history, with sales of over 30 million. While the record company proclaim it has now sold 100 million copies, exact figures are impossible to obtain, but 60 to 70 million might be closer to the truth, and subsequent anniversary released editions will only add to that total. Sales were only one contributing factor to the album's success. Firstly, Billie Jean, Beat It and Thriller broke down MTV's racial barriers. Secondly, it was one of the first albums to be released simultaneously worldwide, and thirdly, it started a trend of turning studio albums into greatest hits albums. Born in the USA, Purple Rain and Hysteria would imitate Thriller shortly afterwards with numerous single releases. Record shipments had declined by 50 million units between 1980 and 1982, and Quincy wanted to make a record that would encourage people to go back into the record stores. I think it's fair to say he accomplished that, and with the rise of digital downloads nowadays, it's unlikely another album will ever dominate radio or TV the way Thriller did.
When asked in later years about Thriller, Quincy said, Michael didn't create Thriller. It takes a team to make an album. He wrote four songs, sang his ass off, but he didn't conceive it. That's not how an album works. Jones gave particular credit to the contributions of engineer Bruce Swedeen and songwriter Rod Temperton. We leave the final words to Quincy to reflect on Michael and the legacy of Thriller.
Well, listen, man, let me put it like this. I never have any doubt how it's going to be. You know, when a record goes to number one, everything then from, as I said, starts with songs. We had killer songs that went everywhere. And it's no, I don't think it's an accident that it hit everybody from 8 to 70, man, everywhere in the world. That's never happened before. I mean, you know, a young black kid to be the idol of so many millions of kids all over the world, it never happened really before. Not on that level, you know. Where does the surprise come from? I mean, everybody in the world goes in to make a number one record. Everybody. So when you get a number one record, you shouldn't be surprised, you know. I mean, something this big, you should be not only surprised, but gracious and feel blessed, you know, and get on your knees, you know, because you don't, nobody knows how to aim at anything like that. You can't, man. That's got something to do with something with divinity. It really does. Anybody that tells me they know how to make an album like this is lying, you know, because you can't plan it.
Creating Thriller was presented and mixed by myself, Roy Jennings, and written and produced by Mick Lynch. Sadly, Michael Jackson is no longer with us, but his legacy and his music will outlive us all.
Can you dig it?
Ha ha ha.